We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. What's the cover? Starting with local, and yesterday was a big day for elections.
Yeah, it was. Yesterday was the filing deadline by which prospective candidates had to file in order to be on the ballot for the August primary, the top two primary that selects two people in each race to square off in November. And most of the action, as will be the case really for the rest of the year, was in the mayor's race for local elections this year. And the big news, of course, was that Tim Burgess, who had raised the most money of any candidate in the mayor's race in the crowded field, did not actually file and announced that he was dropping out of the race. That came as quite a surprise. He had raised over $230,000 already for the mayor's race, most of it from downtown business interests. The Seattle Times and other sort of cheerleaders for the business establishment in the city had really been backing Burgess pretty much since the moment Mike McGinn was elected as mayor 4 years ago. And he'd long been considered, even before a number of other big names had gotten in the race, to be the leading candidate to replace McGinn. He had raised a lot of money, but his campaign never really caught fire. And in fact, the sort of word on the street is that the reason he dropped out is that the internal polling that was being done by his campaign showed him doing very poorly against not only McGinn, but also Ed Murray and Peter Steinbrück and Bruce Harrell, which is interesting because, with that much money in the bank, you would think, and not that many people outside sort of, political circles paying attention to the August primary yet, you would think that they wouldn't be too worried about that because a lot of people in this kind of crowded field are going to be making up their minds really in the last 3 or 4 weeks of the campaign, and you can do an awful lot of convincing with that much money. The downside to that is, of course, that with so many people in the race, it's hard to get enough attention to have that money make more of an impact. That's one issue. And you really have to wonder also if there wasn't some sort of backroom deal being cut on this. In Burgess's statement, he was very explicit that he wanted to see McGinn being replaced, which tells you a couple of things. It tells you that that even though McGinn would be the logical person to take a lot of Burgess's support and a lot of his donors, he's been very much in the last couple of years trying to appeal to the downtown establishment. When we saw that particularly around the proposed Sonics move, around his defense of SPD, and his pushing pretty relentlessly around South Lake Union development and other developer-friendly policies. It makes you think that other candidates in the race, particularly Ed Murray and Peter Steinbrück, who have been trying to run as progressives and populists, are probably going to move to the center a little bit to try and claim some of that support. So there's that interesting tack. We also had a couple of new people in the mayor's race yesterday. One of them, Doug McQuaid, an attorney who ran for state Supreme Court and obviously didn't win last year from West Seattle. He's running. And then Joey Gray, an environmental and local activist, has been involved in the Occupy movement. And I probably shouldn't do too much to describe her because I have to do disclosure here. I'm helping her. So when it comes to the mayor's race, I think probably at least in the primary, depending on how she does, I'm going to defer to Maria to be talking about the mayor's race. That also tells you that I think she's pretty good. Somebody who will not tack to the center the way that Steinbrück and Murray and Harrell have been doing on different issues from time to time through the race and may do more of now that Burgess is out. The city council races, there are 4 seats up for election this year. The incumbents are running in all of them, and frankly, it's going to be pretty boring. And only 2 of the races are there even opponents that are running serious campaigns, those being the people who are running against Michael Bryan. There's a Asian American businessman named Albert Chin who's really trying to appeal a lot to the business community against O'Brien, who is along with Nick Licata, one of the two progressives on the council. And then the other contested race is Richard Conlon, who's drawn 2 pretty active opponents. One of them, Shama Sawant, the socialist alternative candidate who did very well against Frank Chopp last year, and the other, Brian Carver, who nobody really knows that much about him, although he's positioning himself as a progressive and then he's raised a fair amount of his own money so far for the race also. So those will be active. I know for a fact there was another major name looking at joining the Conlon race who decided at the last moment not to. And Sally Bagshaw has one opponent still, who basically is a Republican nut job, not to put too fine a point on it. And then Nick Licata drew a Socialist Workers Party candidate, and it tells you just how bankrupt the process is when the most conservative of the four people running in terms of Bagshaw draws an even more conservative candidate as her only opponent, and then the most progressive incumbent running, Nick Licata, draws a socialist opponent. It's a broken system. And, you know, the fact that the amount of money you have to raise for council positions is enormous because they're all at large seats really has, I think, kept a lot of people out this year. It gives enormous advantages to the incumbent, and it makes the argument for the district system that is going to be an initiative that will almost certainly be on the November ballot. From what I understand, the folks who are organizing that have enough signatures at this point to get it on the November ballot, so we're going to be talking about that come this fall.
Yeah. This week, too, there was data released on the campaign fundraising for April. One of the things I found kind of interesting is that initiative for districts for city council elections is pretty far in the hole at this point. They may have enough signatures to qualify for the ballot, but they don't have a whole lot in their campaign chest for campaigning once they get on the ballot, which is not good news. On the other hand, better news, I-522 to require labeling of genetically modified food in Washington State, that's a statewide initiative, has taken in more than $1 million. So they have plenty of money to fight against any big agribusiness companies or food companies that come in and say, oh no, this is, you know, labeling genetically modified food is too much trouble. Also looking at the campaign fundraising numbers for April, the mayoral candidates race I found particularly interesting because, as Jobs said, Tim Burgess didn't file, and he was the leader of the pack in terms of fundraising. His total fundraising was $231,979 up to that point. And the fact that he had almost double some of the other, or more than some of the other candidates in the race and then decided not to run, I find very interesting, too. And I'll also be interested to see who he endorses when it comes to the primary. Number two on that list is Mike McGinn. He's raised $181,000. And then behind him, surprise, Charlie Stedeker, who has no name recognition, has raised $152,000, a little more than $152,000. That's primarily what he's been doing. He hasn't been talking about the issues, really. He hasn't been putting himself out there in terms of what he stands for. He's been mostly fundraising. He's a fundraising machine. Ed Murray is the next one on the list. He's raised about almost $124,000. He's done an outstanding job fundraising, but again, he hasn't put anything out there in terms of what differentiates him from the other progressive candidates.
Can I throw something in on Murray? Both of those speak to the unique challenge he has because he's the only candidate who's in the legislature.
Yes.
And is prohibited by law from campaigning during the legislative session.
Yeah.
About $100,000, and some of that wouldn't have been reported in the April period, he raised in the 14-day period between the end of the legislative session and the beginning of the special session.
Yeah.
When he had a window where he could raise money.
Yeah, these numbers are just through the end
right,
of April.
And the legislative session ended, I think, about 4 or 5 days before the end of the month. So it would have captured some of that, but not all of it. So he actually is very, very good at raising money.
So, yeah, his total is probably up there closer to what Tim Burgess had.
Yeah, but he hasn't been able to get out there publicly because he's been using those relatively small windows, like the time between the legislative session. He's been focused on raising money rather than you know, getting out there in the headlines and the little opportunity he has.
He's really been working his connections in the gay community to get a lot of funds in the door. So right now, that's where his big base of support lies. Bruce Harrell is the next one on the list. He's raised a little over $100,000, about $112,000 total. And then Peter Steinbrück is number six. He's raised about $62,000. And I want to point out that's about a third of what McGinn has raised.
Yeah. From what I understand, as of about a week ago, he was up to about 90. So it's a little bit better,
so
but still last
creeping
on that
up
list.
There. Yeah.
Still last on that list.
Still creeping up there. And if you add it all together, just the numbers through April, all of the candidates have raised nearly $1 million, and we're not even to the halfway point in terms of campaigning for the November election. So.
Not just in the November election.
I know that we're going to the primaries.
Yeah, but. even with the primaries, the usual timeline for fundraising on the primaries is that for the end of April represents maybe about a third to a quarter of what people will have by early August. By early August, not November, just
so
by
this
August.
So this is going to be, I think, a record-breaking campaign in terms of the amount of money that's going to be raised and spent.
It's a little bit front-loaded because so many people have been focused on raising money early because there are so many candidates, but you're still looking by the time everything is said in November and done in November, you could easily have $8 or $9 million raised for this race.
Yeah, so I think it's going to break records in the city of Seattle. And again, it highlights too, this is the mayoral race, but imagine if you're running for city council and having to collect that kind of money. Now, typically you have to spend more money for the mayor's race, but not always, because folks who run for mayor tend to have more name recognition. You don't always have to spend quite as much as someone who's trying to get on city council who has no name recognition.
Yeah, more name recognition, and it gets much more media attention too.
Mm-hmm.
All right, on to proposed closure with the Seattle schools.
Rally and protest this week down at the Glass Palace, otherwise known as the John Stanford Center for Excellence in Displaying Contempt Toward the Public. The Seattle School District proposing closing the Indian Heritage High School, which has been a long-standing program that specifically caters to the needs of Native American students in the school district, really has been somewhat adrift since the death of founder Bob Eaglestat some years ago. And over the last several years, as is the case with really all the other alternative high schools in the district, or most of them, the Seattle School, and particularly because those alternative schools often don't fit into the neat little box of teaching to the test that the school district administrators seem so obsessed by, you've had budgets and personnel decisions really seriously undercutting the mission of those alternative schools. In the case of Indian Heritage, they have moved out most of the Native teachers. They've discontinued most of the explicitly Native American oriented programs, and now they're talking about shutting down the program entirely. Now this is particularly notable because this comes at exactly the same time that the Department of Education, the federal agency, is already investigating the Seattle School District for civil rights complaints about Native Americans and how they treat Native Americans that have been filed against the district. And in fact, this week also, the Indian Civil Rights Commission announced that it was strongly considering, that's their phrase, filing a lawsuit against SSD because of how they treat Native Americans. Native American students have the highest discipline rates in the district, the highest dropout rates in the district among different ethnic and racial groups. Their test scores are the lowest in the Seattle school district. And here you have the school district, not only pulling back on the programs that specifically cater to those concerns, they're not talking about closing the one school that's specifically founded to try and address those unique challenges. It really tells you once again that the new superintendent, Jose Banda, who a lot of people hoped would bring a breath of fresh air into the sort of stale bureaucracy that is SSD, that really has historically over the past number of years been not just unresponsive but contemptuous of parent concerns, of community concerns, that we're really seeing more of the same, that they are just completely tone deaf into what the needs of their students are.
All right. On to new proposed health insurance rates.
Yeah, on Tuesday, the insurance commissioner's office released the new proposed health insurance rates that will take effect after October 1st, when the new health insurance exchange in Washington will go into operation under the Obamacare law. These rates, which I think are very interesting, they don't reflect the massive rate increases that insurance company executives were warning us about when Congress was considering the Affordable Health Care Act. The new health insurance exchange, I just want to remind people, is going to allow people to compare plans, people who have to buy individual policies, to compare plans from different insurance providers and see the costs of these plans side by side. And these plans will all have to provide a certain number of benefits so that then you're comparing plans apples to apples instead of apples to oranges like people have been doing in the past.
And this is the exact system that we've been talking about in recent weeks that Republican governors in red states have been refusing to implement. So the feds are going to have to come in and do it. That won't be the case in Washington state.
Right. In Washington state, the Washington state government and legislature said, well, yes, we are going to start setting up the exchange, and the commissioner's office tasked insurance companies with coming up, gave them the list of, you know, here's the benefits that you have to include. Now give me a list of the types of plans that you would make available and what your costs, you know, what the monthly insurance premiums would be to purchase those plans. And so far he's received a lot of input back from the insurance companies. So one of the things insurance company executives had warned people about was, oh, if Obamacare passes, then only, you know, these exchanges won't work because only one or two companies will participate.
Wrong.
That's not the case. At least five major companies are participating in every county in the state of Washington, and many, many other counties have more than that. And the rates are, for the most part, better than if you would be trying to shop for individual insurance on the market right now, particularly for people who are 40 years old and older. People who are under 40 would probably have slightly higher rates. However, the Affordable Care Act says, and the Washington Insurance Exchange will provide for people who are 30 years and younger the ability to purchase high deductible catastrophic coverage if they're fairly healthy and don't need complete more comprehensive coverage. Now, also, if you make less than 400% of the federal poverty level, you will qualify for a federal subsidy for your insurance premiums, so not everyone will pay the full amount. So overall, for the majority of people, particularly people who have lower incomes, these rates are going to be much, much more affordable.
Yeah, one of the things that's been lost in all the noise Republicans have generated around the Affordable Care Act is and how it will, you know, bankrupt the federal treasury and cost so much money and so forth. No, it actually saves quite a bit of money to the government, and it saves quite a bit of money for consumers as well. And the whole purpose of all the Republican obstruction on this up front is that they are fully aware that especially next year when the health insurance exchanges come online and some of these other provisions come online, that once it begins to be implemented on a more wide scale basis, it's going to become very popular, and it will be very hard to repeal at that point, which mm-hmm. is why you've had so much noise around it right now.
Yeah, they're trying to avoid implementing as much of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act as they can. You know, because once it's in place, getting rid of it's going to be hard because people are going to like it as much as they like Social Security.
All right. Student loan debt.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York released a study this week on student loan debt. Student loan debt in America has reached a new record. It's over $1 trillion now in total. And what the study found, too, is that people who are in their 20s and 30s who have student loans outstanding are much less likely to have other types of debt. That includes home mortgages, auto loans, and credit card debt. And that kind of makes sense if you really think about it. Lots of their disposable income is really going to pay off student loans, so that means that they can't turn around and make major purchases and do other spending that would help to boost the economy. So what I would like to do is just think for a moment with everybody where that money is going from the pockets of 20 and 30-year-olds who are now well-educated and who are able to get fairly good-paying jobs. That money that they're not spending in the economy is going to banks, which means it's going into the pockets of bank CEOs and executives with record pay packages. It's going to the bank's shareholders. Think for a minute about the high-flying stock market and why is the stock market doing so well when the rest of the economy is not. That money is also, of course, going to universities, not necessarily because professors are being paid a lot, but because universities are increasingly relying on tuition to fund their operations as state budgets are depriving them of funding. And the money that's not going into state is not going into state budgets for a couple of reasons, partly because the federal government is no longer funding education to the levels that it used to because we're spending way too much money in wars overseas. And also because the economy is in the doldrums and states are not collecting the type of tax revenues they did in the past. They, you know, their revenues rely on people's increasing incomes. And in the state of Washington, a lot of it's based on the sales tax. If people don't buy stuff, the state government doesn't collect much revenue. The economy, of course, is in the doldrums because there's not enough consumer spending, because people owe too much on their underwater home mortgages and in student debt. So it's a vicious cycle. So I just wanna let people know where we are, and that this Federal Reserve Bank study I thought was a very revealing study.
All right. Multiple scandals making the corporate media this
week. Let's put the word scandals in quote, because there's three major ones right now being targeted at the Obama administration, and in every single one of the cases there's not much there, and the details are different. There's more things to be concerned about in some rather than others. Let's start with the most trivial, which would be Benghazi, which has been dragged on by Republican partisans for about 6 months now. And you know, we're still talking. There was a public release this week of emails from the Obama administration, which are the same emails that were shown to congressional Republicans and Democrats 2 months ago. And while the emails at that point were not made public themselves, there was nothing to prohibit the Republican or Democratic congresspeople from talking about the contents publicly, and they did not, because there was nothing there. It basically showed that in the aftermath of the attack on the consulate at Benghazi, that, you know, various agencies were scrambling to try and figure out what was going on, because they didn't necessarily know. Different pieces of the government had different parts of the information. And number two, they didn't want to compromise their security by tipping off what they knew about some of the radical elements that were involved. And so Susan Rice, who was the ambassador to the UN at the time, went on the Sunday shows and gave talking points that were not fully forthcoming. That's what this whole thing is about. And, you know, if lying on the Sunday morning talk shows were a prosecutable offense, John McCain would be in The Hague right now. I mean, this happens every week.
Yeah, exactly.
There's really nothing there.
It's not about the real issue, which is what were we doing what are we doing in the Middle East? I mean, what is the point of the war on terrorism? And this is just another tragedy in the war on terrorism. And why are we involved in that?
You know? Exactly. We also had President Obama doing what he does best, which is throwing somebody under the bus to try and hit off a fake scandal this week, with the head of the IRS resigning under pressure due to a lot of noise being made about the IRS taking a careful look at 501c4 applications for Tea Party nonprofits. And this, let me say a little bit about this. We're talking about there's a couple different nonprofit statuses with the IRS, 501c3 and 501c4. The C3s are the activist organizations. 501c4s are supposed to be educational organizations that have very, very strict limits on the amount of political activity that they can do. I've been an executive director for both types of organizations, and any organization like that knows full well what the limits are and has to work very carefully. The IRS in this case, in terms of trying to interpret the law, was completely correct.
In the right, yes.
Because, you know, a Tea Party organization by definition is a political organization, and of course you want to look carefully at exactly mm-hmm. what type of work they're doing and whether it is in fact political in nature. And the real scandal about this, frankly, was that none of those applications were in the end denied. They were all approved.
Either approved or they were set aside for very long periods of time, which I should point out is not unusual with the IRS.
It's not unusual at all with the IRS. And the one 501c4 that was actually applications actually rejected was for a liberal organization.
Yeah.
It, you know, there really is no scandal there at all. And you know, Obama just added fuel to it by sacrificing the head of the IRS to this. He should know by now that that doesn't keep the wolves at bay. It just whets their appetite. And then finally, we had probably the most serious of the three scandals, which is the Department of Justice subpoenaing AP phone records over the leak of an undercover operation in Yemen. The fact that the Department of Justice was investigating this is actually pretty justifiable, given that you had a live field agent out there whose identity and existence was compromised by the AP story. In the 5 days between when the AP originally went to the White House with this this. And when they went ahead and published it, the White House was trying to get them to delay publication. And they were doing it because, British and Saudi agencies were also involved. They had to scramble to extract the guy from the field. There wound up being an assassination in the course of this of an al-Qaeda leader in Yemen. And British law, isn't this quaint, actually prohibits assassinations. We used to have that here, mm-hmm. too. So there were international relations complications with the story being published. There was a compromise of a pretty valuable field asset, and it was a pretty defensible operation if you think we should be involved in the war on terror at all. That being said, and really you have to question what the motivation of the person within the intelligence agencies who leaked the existence of this operation, what their motivation was and what that says about the internal politics there. That to me is actually the more interesting story. But in terms of subpoenaing AP phone records, the subpoena was overbroad. It went after the messenger rather than the original problem, which is the leaker. And it sets a really dangerous precedent.
Yeah, and you would think that after this, the media in general would be more critical and more questioning of things like the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, types of laws that have been passed in the war on terrorism that would allow the government to do this, to come in and just seize phone records without telling anybody and to be able to listen in on phone conversations between AP reporters and their confidential sources. But so far, the media hasn't kicked up much of a storm.
And that shouldn't be much of a surprise to anybody who's been following it, because for really since 9/11, there have been a number of incidents like this, not with the AP and generally not with, with really large media organizations, but certainly with a lot of smaller ones. That precedent has been set a long time ago, and we've seen over and over again that mainstream corporate media's allegiance to freedom of the press is almost always trumped by their allegiance to the powers that be.
Mm-hmm.
Just over a minute left for Bangladesh.
Yeah, European clothing retailers this week signed on to a comprehensive plan to improve worker safety in Bangladesh. More than 30 companies in Europe, including H&M, Carrefour, Mango, Primark, Benetton, just a whole bunch of them. But only two companies in the U.S. have signed on, Abercrombie & Fitch and PVH Corporation, which is the parent company of Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger.
Not Disney, not Walmart.
Not Gap, no. I just wanted to put out there a list of some groups that people can join if you want to put pressure on Gap, Walmart, Sears, JCPenney, et cetera. You can join the Industrial Global Union, that's the group that drafted the comprehensive plan, the Worker Rights Consortium, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, or one of my favorite groups, United Students Against Sweatshops.
Yeah, they're great. And they have an active chapter at UW. Meanwhile, the actual search for bodies in that tragedy in Bangladesh was finally called off this week. There was actually a person still found in the rubble over last weekend. The final death toll put at 1,127, which is actually probably conservative.
Making it the worst accident in the history of the garment industry.
Absolutely. And meanwhile, you had another tragedy, another Asian sweatshop tragedy this week outside Phnom Penh in Cambodia, when a floor piled dangerously high in a shoe factory collapsed from the weight. Three people killed, six people killed, over 100 injured on Wednesday. Just as the tragedy in Bangladesh, it was no surprise on March 27th that workers in the plant had stopped work and blocked a main road in a protest over wages and working conditions and worker safety.
Yeah, and a lot of retailers are taking the Bangladesh factory collapse as an excuse to leave Bangladesh and go elsewhere. I think people need to put pressure on them to say, no, you stay where you're at and you help to improve conditions in those countries. Don't just flee to the next country with the lower wages and less worker safety.
And again, I know we're out of time, but the fact that these companies just go from country to country like this looking for amenable conditions when you have regulation finally put in place in places like Bangladesh after a tragedy means that the real point of leverage is at the consumer end,
yes,
and at the stockholder end in this country.
Talking as we do every week with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And this, as every week, we'll be posting the notes from the stories you heard on the show with links and more information that you can get on them.